It's the 25th of October 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. What on earth is Helen Chersky doing spending 6 weeks on a boat? And does she at least not have to worry about Rory McGrath turning up? Is there any fallout from the government building a new nuclear power plant? Is David Byrne angry at Spotify or just those kids of today standing on his lawn? And is an English degree worth more than a doctorate from a degree mill? But before we begin, this episode of The Pod Delusion is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. Stay tuned to this week's show for details on getting a 10% discount. That's right, we've got sponsorship. So let's start the show this week in the ocean. You may remember that a few weeks ago, we spoke to TV's Helen Chersky, who in addition to making clever science documentaries for the BBC, is also a scientist. One thing she is definitely not, though, is a landlubber, which is why she explained to us that days after the previous interview, she was off to spend 6 weeks on a boat floating somewhere in the North Atlantic. We like a challenge here at the Pod Delusion, so we thought, why don't we see if we can catch up with her whilst she's still on the boat, out in the middle of nowhere? So last night, Liz Luckendorf spoke to Helen about the bubbles and the storms.
So can you tell us where you are exactly? Or are you just basically out in the North Atlantic, or do you know more precisely where you are?
I'm not anywhere. There's screens around here that have coordinates on them. Oh, there might be a computer just here. I can have a look. Oh, where's the page gone? Where's the page? It's got latitude and longitude on it. Oh, I don't know where that is. Anyway, we're about 53 north and about 46 west, somewhere around there. So out just sort of south of Greenland, about a couple of hundred miles, maybe, something like that. You know, if you go down to the point of Greenland, you keep going south of it, we're bobbing about there.
So how did you get there? Is it a bit of a journey?
Well, the amazing thing about being on the ship is that you sort of have the freedom of the ocean. You know, when you're on land, you're kind of constrained, right? You have to go where the roads are. And when you're at sea, you just kind of point yourself at a bit of the ocean and go, right, we'll go there. So we left Greenland and went out a little way, and then we sort of did a bit of a zigzag around looking for different conditions in the ocean. So we've been doing a mixture of things. Sometimes we've been going in a straight line because we've got somewhere we want to go. And sometimes when we put the buoy over the side, what we'll do is just bob along and float with it. And then it looks like an etch-a-sketch, basically. Someone possibly who's drunk using an etch-a-sketch, they're a little wiggly line. So we bob about all over the place. And then we'll pull it back in and go somewhere else and go in a straight line. So it's been a bit of a weird journey to get here, sort of mixture of direct transit and little bobbing around, not doing very much.
So have you found your storm? I know you were, when we interviewed a few weeks ago, the point was to get into a storm and sit there. Has there been quite big storms?
There's been a couple, and what's about to happen, actually, is probably the biggest yet. So we had a couple of big ones earlier on. Let's see, we've been out here 2 weeks, and we've probably had two proper storms and a few stormy bits and pieces. And then tomorrow, so we've just put our buoy in the ocean. We put it there this morning, and the wind's rising now. I think it's about 20 knots an hour. We're expecting it to get to 50 knots about 12 hours from now. And the predicted sea state is that there'll be waves that are 10 or 12 meters high. And it's all only going to last for a day, we think. So we're waiting for that to blow past, and that'll be the biggest storm yet. The reason we're out here is it's really hard to measure in these high wind speeds, and I think what we're about to get in the next 24 hours might be the highest we'll get on the whole cruise.
Oh my god. So 12 metres, are you just going to like tie yourself to a bunk and not move for the whole storm?
Well, the advantage actually, it's actually a lot easier when you're not trying to go somewhere. The way that the easiest thing to do in a storm is actually just to point the nose of the ship to where the wind's coming from. And let it all wash past you. And if you're not trying to move through it, actually, you'll just sort of ride up and down on top of it, and it's not that bad. If you're trying to go across the wind, so if we were trying to go south and the wind was coming from the east, that's really, really bumpy. But since we're not trying to move, it sounds terrifying, and it looks terrifying when, you're on the bridge of the ship and there's just this wall of water in front of you, and then it just vanishes underneath you and the next one comes along. But we're just bobbing about on top of it, and it actually, it's definitely rough, but because we're not trying to go anywhere, it's not as bad as it could be.
So, what is the buoy actually measuring?
So what we're doing is trying to understand how the ocean breathes, and So there's lots of scientists on the ship measuring different gases and particles coming in and going out of the ocean. And my bit is a bit different. So we think that bubbles help the ocean breathe. So as bubbles underneath breaking waves sort of taken down into the ocean, and then as they come up to the surface and pop, they're little elevators for gases and particles. And so in order to get to where the bubbles are, you can't just sit on the ship and watch, so you have to get in the water. Unfortunately, I don't have to do that personally. So I've got this big, long, yellow buoy, which is 11 metres tall. It's got six in the ocean, just on top of it above water. And what it's got underneath the water is lots of devices for measuring bubbles. So it's got a sonar for looking at the shape of bubble plumes, and various acoustic devices and a high-speed camera to look at the bubbles themselves. And the idea is that while this enormous storm is going on, with waves breaking over the top, all of these instruments below the waterline will be actually looking at individual bubbles, looking at how big they are, how long they last, where they are, and trying to piece together some of that mystery underneath the water, because we've all seen breaking waves from the top, but actually getting at the underneath it, where all the important stuff happens, is quite a lot harder. So this buoy is designed to try and measure some of that.
So you had some earlier problems with your buoy, as we were following on Twitter and things like that. What went wrong, and like, how do you fix something in the middle of the ocean on a boat?
Oh, I feel like I fixed everything. The problem with this sort of work, firstly, is that it's slightly unpredictable. And secondly, like you say, you are in the middle of the ocean. You have limited resources. So I had two problems, really. We had two problems. One of them was that the second time the buoy went out, when it came back in, just as they were craning it over the side, and imagine this huge, very heavy buoy coming in horizontally. Once that starts swinging, it starts to look a bit like a wrecking ball. And so the ship rolled at just the wrong moment, and the delicate top end of it smashed against the ship. And it was still there and went, oh! And it definitely came back in more pieces than it went out, and some of the pieces didn't come back at all. And that's the sort of thing that happens, which is why we have loads and loads of spares with it. So we spent a few days basically reconstructing everything, some scratch in some cases. And I had a few other things to fix, because I've got a lot of new experiments that have been tried out in big seas before, so they've needed a bit of tweaking. So I feel like I've spent all of the past 2 weeks with a spanner in my hand and fixing everything. That's, you know, it's all right as long as it gets fixed. And I think I fixed it, and now it's all gone back in the warm, so I can not worry about it for 3 days. But the reason we're out here actually for quite a long time, we're out here for just over 5 weeks in total, is firstly because weather doesn't always arrive when we want, and secondly because everyone knows these difficult conditions, things are going to go wrong. So in order to get what you want, you plan for a bit of extra time, so you plan for this fixing time. Even though you don't know what it is beforehand, you're going to have to fix.
Was there something specific that you're predicting to find out? Like, do you have a specific hypothesis, or are you just trying to collect as much data as possible?
I have a few. There are lots of little hypotheses too, like, so what we think is happening is at very, very high wind speed. So in the ocean's freezing all the time across the surface, but obviously as you get bigger winds, you get bigger waves, you get more bubbles, you get more mixing. So we think, first of all, that bubbles are making a contribution to the amount the ocean freezes. No one's actually ever directly proved that. It's very, very likely, but we don't know when that matters and where it matters. And maybe it matters in cold water, but not in warm water. Maybe it matters when there are things growing in the ocean, but not otherwise. So, and basically, we hardly have any data at all. So the point of being out here in these horrible conditions is to try and get just some measurements at very high wind speeds to get an idea about what's going on. And then after that, I've got theories about bubble behavior, because I also do lab work. So I think that, for example, temperature makes a difference to how bubbles fall. And if it does that in the lab, maybe it does it in the ocean. So it would be lovely to see those differences as well. But I think for this first go, it's just going to be the very big differences, and we might get the details later on.
From the previous time the buoy's been out, have you got some good data from that, or have you not had a chance to look at it?
I haven't had much of a chance to look at it, because I have been doing a lot of fixing things. But it definitely has missed. It's been out in some good conditions. The sonar data is actually the thing I like the most. So the sonar is sitting 8 metres underwater, and it's looking back up at the surface. This is really cool, because you can see the sea surface. You can see waves coming along towards the buoy, and you can see waves breaking. And so you've got a sort of cross-section through the ocean at that point, which is just lovely data. I really love watching that, because You know those pictures, you sometimes get those put together pictures of icebergs where you can see the tip of the iceberg at the top and then there's a great big image of all the stuff underneath. It's a bit like being able to see that underneath it. So we can see from the cameras on top, we can see the brain waves at the top. And then suddenly you have the sonar data and other acoustic data and you can see all that stuff underneath you couldn't see before. But at the moment I can see it. I haven't done any analysis to, because what we want to do is match it with the conditions, you know, when the wind's doing this, what the bubble's doing, when the temperature's doing this, what the bubble's doing. And I haven't got to that analysis yet. But I can definitely see these big plumes of bubbles coming in, which is really exciting because I study these things, right? And I don't ever get to actually see them. This is as close as it gets, really, to actually seeing them in the open ocean because they're always hidden below the surface.
Cool. Are other people doing research as well? Are there other kind of buoys or anything else that other people are doing?
So we're the only people who are putting things over the side. There's another little buoy that's going out. So there's buoys and buoys, right? So I learned my oceanography in America, so I tend to say buoy, but the British say buoy, and I know you would say buoy. So there's a little yellow thing called a wave rider, which just bobs up and down on top of the wave and has an accelerometer in it. So for measuring the acceleration, you can tell, you can actually measure directly what the surface of the sea is doing and how rough it is and how choppy it is and whether they're big, smooth waves or lots of mixed-up waves of different sizes. So that's the only other thing that's going over the side. Everything else is measuring on the ship, which is why we have to be in the middle of the storm. So there's a big mast on the front of the ship, an extra mast, and it sticks right up at the front where the ship can't affect the measurement. And the device up there are taking the atmosphere, basically, and sucking it down into labs just underneath and measuring the different gases that are in it. So lots of gases that come and go across the ocean surface. So carbon dioxide is the main one, but also acetone, methane, various other organic and sulfur compounds. So we're sort of like smelling the breath of the ocean, but that doesn't sound very nice. it's something like that. So that's all at the top of the ship. And there's also something up there that's measuring particles. So, you know, when you hold a fizzy drink up to your nose and you feel little particles being spat upwards, the white horses on the ocean, these foam patches are almost spitting particles upwards. So we're also measuring those particles. And that's pretty much everything. There's gases and particles and then there's bubbles and a few other little bits of pieces. But just getting that done is a huge amount of work that's keeping shipboard people happy.
So what is it like to be on the boat, aside from when you're madly fixing various bits and pieces? What do you do all day?
It's not as claustrophobic as you think. The first time I went on the ship, I was really worried that I would get cabin fever really, really quickly. And I didn't in the end, because you sort of accept your surroundings. So there's a big main lab, which is where I'm standing now. And it's got tables and benches and, you know, loads of tools everywhere. Down below, there are the cabins where we sleep. And then upstairs there are rooms, you know, there's a mess deck, so there's a dining room, cafeteria area, and a little library, and just stuff, you know, it's like a little mini village, basically, that's floating. So you get used to the motion very, very quickly. I can feel now the ship swaying underneath me. I just had to take a step backwards and stop myself falling over backwards. And we're not even really swaying much at the moment. So you get used to the constant movement and you always keep a hand free because you don't know when you're going to be rolled into a wall and have to push yourself off it. Everything's strapped down. It really makes you appreciate gravity when you're on land, because when you're on land, gravity always points in the same direction. You can kind of rely on the fact that if you've got a box on the table, it will still be on the table the next morning. Whereas here, with that whole, you know, that sort of cartoon thing almost where everyone's at dinner and the plates all fly sideways, that happens. So there are sort of rubber mats on the table that prevent it, but quite frequently, if the ship rolls quickly, everything scoops off down the table. So all the tables have a sort of lip at the edge, so some stuff falling off the edge. There's all these sort of little adaptations. You spend your life strapping things down and putting things away. I'm tidier on a ship than I am almost anywhere else, because if you're not tidy, everything ends up on the floor. Which I suppose is the same as if you weren't tidy in the first place. But it makes your untidiness more extreme. Get used to it, but it is just, you know, people just get on and work.
I imagine you have like a proper ship's captain and stuff. I imagine most people would be like, let's get away from the storm, and you're like, no, let's go directly to bad storms. Do they look at you funny for wanting to do this?
Yeah, so ships normally would run away from this because it's not very much fun for people on board. But this ship operates in the North Atlantic all the time, and They normally they're trying to go places, which is actually far worse. Like I said, if you're just bobbing about, you tend to ride over the top of it. But if you're actually trying to plow through it, that's when it gets nasty. And this ship is out here in the North Atlantic almost all year round, and they're very used to having to go places through it. So actually, they're quite used to the bumpiness. Doesn't bother them at all. They're very going ho about it all.
Cool. And I guess my last question is, do you think that there's any bubbles in Hawaii that need looking at in sometime in the summer? In the calm ocean.
You know, I went to Hawaii once to look for bubbles. I spent a month of my life in the Pacific Ocean on a ship looking for bubbles. And it was part of the study of optics in the ocean. And you can imagine that those bubbles make the ocean look a little bit more white. And so I was there. And we did not see a single breaking wave the whole time I was out there. So sadly for me, I've been to Hawaii and looked for bubbles. And I have discovered there are very, in the bit of the ocean we were in, there are very few bubbles to be studied. I'm sure there are better bits. But sadly, I've tried that. So I can't try that one again. I'm working on the topics. Definitely working on trying to find some bubbles in the tropics that we're studying.
Jamaica, Cuba, something like that. It would be good.
Yeah.
Cool. So you have a few more weeks left in the boat. How many more storms do you think you might come across? Like, how many more times will you be able to put the buoy out?
Well, we have three more weeks. We're going to need 4 days to get back to Good Pole in Massachusetts, which is where we're going back to. So we've probably got maybe 16 more days at sea. So the thing with the storms is, it looks like there's going to be a lot of storms, but there might not be any gaps in between them. So we need some periods of calm in order to put the buoy in the warm zone and get it out again. So the next opportunity after this weekend to get it back will be on Monday or Tuesday. And we've got a very tight window. And if we don't get it out then, we're just going to have to watch it bob about through the next storm and get it back on board after that. So it depends on how big the gaps between the storms are, because it looks like they're coming pretty continuously from now on. So there's going to be lots of weather, whether we can get the buoy on board and batteries recharged and back out again in time, I'm not sure about. But I'm hoping maybe 2 or 3 more deployments, which is good. That's what we expected. In fact, we're doing much better than we expected, so all good.
Awesome. And you said, I think on Twitter or Facebook, that you're looking to name the buoy on Twitter and taking suggestions. Is that right?
That is right. So last night I got back down to the mainland. The buoy has this kind of dome, like a sphere on top of it, basically, that sticks up above the water. And I got down here to find that the engineer who looked after it had got the electrical tape out and had made a face on it. And no one's quite sure whether it's a cat or a dog, but it sort of got ears and whiskers. And so we're taking suggestions on Twitter for a name. And if the best suggestion, we will make a collar for the buoy so that next time it goes down, it has a collar with his name on it. And just to give you an idea of the standard of the entries so far, there was David Bowie, because the Americans were called boys, buoys. There was Odell Boy, Del Boy the Globetrotter, which I thought was quite clever. But the most popular name by far has been Bob.
Bob.
Of course. If you can do better than that, let us know. And if yours is the best one, voted for by people on the ship, we will name the buoy that and give it a collar with that name on.
Awesome. We will put links to... If you know anyone else who we can tweet at, let us know. But we'll put links out to people to tweet you suggestions. Thanks very much for calling from the North Atlantic.
It was lovely to speak to you. I should go now because it's dinner time.
Okay. Bye.
All right. See you then.
Now, everyone knows that since the 1980s, the idea of the government running public utilities has been silly. You know, the doctrine is all about private sector solutions. And if the best people to run them happen to be companies owned by other countries, then that sort of private sector still? Drew Ray this week has been wondering why nuclear policy seems different across Europe and sends us this amazing report.
On Monday this week, the UK government signed a contract with EDF Energy to build a new nuclear power plant called Hinkley Point C. The plant will be based around a pressurised water reactor designed by France's state-run nuclear corporation, AREVA. The plan is controversial for several reasons. Firstly, it involves significant guarantees by the UK government towards EDF. Mostly this is via the strike price, the amount that the government promises to pay EDF for electricity generated by the plant. If this price ends up being above market rate, the government will be paying more to EDF than it pays to other suppliers. The chance of this happening appears fairly high, since the government's promised a strike price twice the current market rate for electricity, and then indexed that price in line with inflation. Secondly, the deal involves considerable stakeholders by Areva, China General Nuclear Corporation, and China National Nuclear Corporation. In other words, the new reactor, subsidised by the British government, will be around 50% state-owned, just by states other than the United Kingdom. Thirdly, the very idea of building a new nuclear reactor at all bucks a swing against nuclear power in Europe. Switzerland, Germany and France are working to reduce their dependency on nuclear power. In fact, Germany and Switzerland currently intend to completely phase out nuclear power. Italy had expressed plans to build nuclear plants, but it has abandoned those plans. Netherlands has one small reactor remaining, and Lithuania was made to shut down its nuclear power plants as part of joining the EU. In the actively pro-nuclear camp, we have only Sweden, Finland, and now the UK. Finland is currently building one new nuclear reactor, and has plans for a new plant. After Three Mile Island, Sweden introduced a nuclear phase-out policy, just as Germany and Switzerland did after Fukushima, but that policy has been reversed to allow replacement of existing reactors with new reactors. Sitting on the fence, meanwhile, is Norway. Norway doesn't rely on nuclear reactors for power, but is experimenting with a thorium reactor, a new and possibly safer way of producing nuclear power. So why is there no European consensus about nuclear power? Is it that the physical properties of plutonium permeate as you pass through passport control? Are French politicians worried about the ability of French regulators to regulate French companies on French soil, but happy to have those same companies a few miles across the channel under British bureaucracy? Is there a giant dome that protects Hamburg from Swedish fallout, but not from fallout generated in southern Germany? Do the Italians have access to a secret stash of low-cost hydrocarbons that change the economics of energy as you pass the Alps? The answer, of course, is that this is an issue where political forces are much stronger than scientific ones. But let's not jump to the conclusion that it's just another case of politicians ignoring evidence. Nuclear power as an issue has very little in common with something like global warming. Global warming has a clear scientific consensus, but a lack of political consensus for action despite the scientific consensus. Nuclear power, on the other hand, has a lack of political consensus caused, in part, by a lack of scientific consensus. Arguably, it works even stronger in the other direction. Political opinions drive the perceptions of scientists about nuclear power. The clue that this is happening comes from the fact that despite the lack of a scientific consensus, academics who are pro and anti nuclear power are vehement in their opinions about the risks. On episode 15 of my Disastercast podcast, I interviewed sociologist John Downer about the reaction of the nuclear risk assessment community to Fukushima. Connoisseurs of pseudosciences such as homeopathy and parapsychology will recognise many of the tactics used to explain why Fukushima should not be seen as evidence that nuclear risk assessment is deeply flawed. On the other hand, scientists who are anti-nuclear power tend to exaggerate the potential severity of credible worst-case scenarios. It's amazing the number of people who will accept the Intergovernmental Report on Climate Change, but ignore the clear consensus that Chernobyl caused a lot of economic damage, but it had a comparatively low human cost compared to many other non-nuclear industrial accidents. If you're looking for a moral high ground on power generation, science just can't give you a map telling you where to find it. Fossil fuels cause regular deaths where they're extracted, burnt, and end up afterwards. Nuclear power has fewer and smaller accidents, but they're very expensive to clean up. There's also that niggling concern about where to put all the nuclear waste. Wind and solar energy have hidden materials, manufacturing and disposal issues, and hydroelectric power, which seems clean, is responsible for the largest ever industrial accidents. With at least 10 years until the new nuclear power plant is online, with major decisions still to be made about where the rest of the UK's energy will be coming from, we're in for a decade of controversy, poorly informed opinions and unsupported certainty. I suspect, though, that this is not a decision that will be reversed. The question worthy of attention now is how to ensure that this power plant, and the next one regardless of underlying technology, are as safe as we can make them. I hope that the risk researchers and safety regulators will receive a sweetheart deal as generous as the one just made with EDF. This is Drew Ray for The Pod Delusion.
And now a message from our sponsors. This episode of The Pod Delusion is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, as well as 24/7 support. Seamless e-commerce solutions means that your business can be taking money in minutes on a website that is scaled to look beautiful on any computer or device. You can start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Pod Delusion listener, you'll receive a 10% discount on your first purchase by using the offer code DELUSION10. That's DELUSION, number 10, 10. Head over to squarespace.com/poddelusion to find out more. And now back to our regularly scheduled programming. Now, is Spotify killing the television man? This week, David Byrne from Talking Heads has been moaning about changing technology. The common complaint about the modern music industry is that streaming services like Spotify are destroying the recording industry. But doesn't this sound oddly familiar? And were things really that great in the good old days? Steve Page isn't so sure.
Recently, Talking Heads frontman David Byrne penned an opinion piece for The Guardian regarding the rise of streaming sites Spotify and others like it. Byrne insisted that it was the death knell for creative industries, but that his primary concern was for the up-and-coming artist who would receive little or no royalties as a result of what he saw as a carve-up between Spotify and the major labels. Many years ago, I and many like me played in venues where one accepted that one would receive little or no recompense for performing, but we did so because it allowed us to play music to an audience, and there was the possibility that amongst the audience there would be somebody who liked what we did enough to take a punt on it. The Holy Grail, being signed to a major label, meant not only the possibility of fame, fortune and everything that goes with it, but more importantly, the opportunity to record one's music with good quality equipment and to reach a far wider audience. In those days, amateur recording equipment was not of a high enough standard to enable the amateur musician to produce anything that could compete with the typical industry-backed recording artist. Basic arithmetic tells us that only a small number could ever hope to achieve financial success in such a competitive field. To get TV exposure, one typically needed to break into, or be on the verge of breaking into, the top 40, which contained the best-selling artists in a particular week, many of whom rose to public attention 20 or 30 years prior to that chart being compiled. There was only so much space in record shops to display new music, and only a limited amount of airtime for new acts, as first and foremost, the public wanted to hear music by acts that they were familiar with. Getting a slot on Top of the Pops could literally make or break a career, and without achieving that break, it was extremely difficult to carve out a career in an industry dominated by such heavy costs. Recording to a professional standard was hugely expensive. A bog-standard 24-track studio typically cost in excess of £20 an hour, with higher-end studios costing in excess of £100 an hour. And manufacturing, distribution, plug-in, advertising, and so on, meant that unless one had record company backing, or a rich sponsor, one had little chance of breaking the major label hegemony. Of course, there were successful independent labels, but these should be seen as outliers. For every successful indie label, there were tens if not hundreds of others that invested heavily in an act, then folded due to a failure to recoup their losses. Effectively, established indie labels in the 80s and 90s had much the same power as a major label, but at least were more likely than the major label to gamble on an artist in which they believed. They were also more likely to pay their artist a fair cut for their work. For example, Daniel Miller at Mute famously gave Depeche Mode a 50% cut of the profits in return for paying 50% of the costs, whereas a typical recording contract would net an act 12 to 14% after all costs have been paid, and that's without accounting for the managers and the producers' slice. Which brings me back to David Byrne's defence of up-and-coming artists. Using new technology, new media, and new channels of distribution, it's possible for artists to release high-quality recordings for a fraction of the cost that were once impossible to avoid. With a minimal investment in hardware and by using open source software or cheap multi-track recording software such as Reaper, what was once impossible for an unsigned artist is now an everyday occurrence. This technological boon is not limited solely to music, but has seen a boom in the production of content across numerous creative fields. Indeed, an independent show such as The Pod Delusion could not have flourished without these technological advances, as associated costs would have made it extremely difficult for James, Liz, and for volunteers such as myself to collaborate effectively. With the advent of the digital age, however, these difficulties have been overcome. It is no longer impossible for amateur content providers to produce material that is almost indistinguishable from professionally produced material. This is a double-edged sword, and due to the massive rise in the availability of free, high-quality content, content consumers have become accustomed either to paying nothing or paying what they feel is fair for the privilege of accessing it. Whilst I can understand why an individual that benefited so greatly from the previous system would want to see the status quo preserved, Byrne's concerns seem to smack of self-interest when examined more closely. His comment that he is concerned not for himself but for young struggling musicians rings somewhat hollow, given the fact that most young struggling musicians don't start collecting substantial royalties until well after they have established themselves, simply due to the amount of time that it takes for royalties to be collected and redistributed. His claim that the creative industries will die as a result of new media would carry more weight if it had any substance to it, but as I've already stated, the fact is that it is easier than ever before for an act to self-publish, cutting out the industry middleman altogether. In fact, on that note, there's the question of whether art should be an industry at all. I'm not saying that artists should work for free. For what it's worth, I feel that many gigging musicians are underpaid for their labour, given the amount of time spent honing their craft, investing in equipment and so on. But this is a different discussion altogether. Regarding art, however, if one is motivated by the desire to create and publish content, given that it's possible to do so independently these days via the numerous online outlets, then perhaps one should see creating content and being heard as payment in and of itself. As a younger man, with a burning desire to perform and publish, I recall saying that I would settle for covering my rent and food if it allowed me to make my art. And I'm quite confident that the younger, more idealistic Byrne would have felt the same. His recent outburst suggests that he's more concerned that the gravy train, which ploughed through countless talented individuals in the past, but allowed a fortunate few such as himself to get fantastically wealthy, has hit the buffers. Byrne asks why anybody would buy music from an artist when they could get it for free by streaming it from Spotify. Personally, if I feel that an artist is good enough and worth my support, I will buy their product in order to support them, thus enabling them to continue making a product that I enjoy. I will also attempt to see that artist perform live if I am able to, and Byrne acknowledges that it's possible for an act to support itself financially by performing live, by selling merchandise, and by finding new ways to monetize their product, but asks how writers, that is, non-performers, can make a living under the new paradigm. The unfortunate byproduct of technological advance is that some positions become redundant, but that has happened since time immemorial in every industry and will continue to happen in music regardless of the rise of Spotify. One additional factor that Byrne doesn't take into account is how much the public have been exploited by the recording industry's monopoly in the past. 20 years ago, the cost of a current or classic CD was approximately £15. I remember a friend buying the Beatles' double white album for £28 on CD. But there was no other option, aside from the time-honoured tradition of swapping albums to listen to and tape onto cassette. Older listeners will remember the Home Taping is Killing Music campaign that promised, with Skull and Crossbones for extra scare value, that taping an album from a friend would lead to the swift and brutal demise of the music industry. Since other ways became available to access music, however, the industry has had to adapt its business model. As such, in 2013, a new CD regularly retails for half the price that a new CD went for in 1993, but overall sales continue to increase year on year, despite the free or cheap alternatives. This suggests to me that if the public believe they are getting value for money from a product, be it a physical copy or a download, they will not begrudge paying for it. Perhaps what is really eating David Byrne is that his next gold-plated Shark Tank or Gulfstream 4 private jet won't be quite so easy to come by. But with an estimated net worth of $40 million, I'm sure that it will keep a roof over his ridiculously indulged, entitled head. If you wish to support new music, check out venues in your area for unsigned band nights. They are typically free to enter or cost only a small amount for several hours of entertainment, and whilst the quality of the acts may be hit and miss, you might just see something that renews your love of music. Alternatively, look online, for example SoundCloud, Bandcamp or Reverb Nation, for new acts. If you find an act that you enjoy, consider donating a small amount where possible or buying their work. There are some incredible musicians out there that are publishing their own material. Some of my current favourites include ambient electronic act The Glimmer Room, Americana-tinged Lavendor Rogue, and South End-based heavy western outfit Phileas Williams. And instead of, like David Byrne, bemoaning the changes occurring within an industry that has traditionally choked the lifeblood out of struggling artists for years, why not rejoice in those changes? This has been Steve Page, waxing lyrical for the Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, you may have seen the news that a university purporting to be from London was found to be just a degree mill, offering degrees to anyone who paid the tuition fees, which isn't good at all. But does it really matter if someone doesn't have the degree that they claim, if they can actually do the job in hand? Here's Kevin Friary with his thoughts.
I suppose I should give a slight warning at the beginning of this piece. It's not exactly linear. I haven't taken a starting point and gone on a sprint to the finish. Instead, I've taken a sort of taxi driver route around an issue so that we can consider various strands before drawing to a conclusion. There used to be a series on British television called Faking It. If you never saw it, the premise was very simple. They would take a profession that seemed quite complex or specific and take a person who, on the face of it, seemed to have no attributes of the profession, and then, in a series of weekly episodes, they'd show them learning the specific skills needed to fake their way through a performance. Two episodes that stick in my memory were of a punk musician becoming the conductor of a large orchestra and a very genteel public schoolboy becoming a West End bouncer. I always thought there was something disturbing about the programmes, although they were fascinating television. What particularly worried me was the insinuation that with a bit of practice anyone could do these professions, that they didn't need the years of apprenticeship or study that are normally associated with them. This all came to mind again this week when the BBC ran a story on Newsnight about an online university offering postgraduate degrees in return for money, without any need for study. The American University of London, AUOL, awarded a fictitious person created by the programme a Master's in Business Administration in exchange for a $4,500 fee. The programme drew up a one-page fake CV or resume for a management consultant, Peter Smith, known as Pete, living in South London, and it included a 15-year made-up work experience history and a fictitious undergraduate degree from a UK university. The real Pete was, in fact, a dog living in Battersea Dogs Home. Newsnight sent Pete's CV to AUOL along with a completed application for the Masters in Business Administration and a £50 application fee. 4 days after sending in the application, AUL sent Pete an email saying that his application for a degree based on previous experience had been successful, and that once the university had received his £4,500 fee, he would be registered as an MBA graduate within about 2 weeks. A quote from the BBC News website. One of the many worrying aspects of the story is that there are hundreds of people employed in the UK who include an MBA from the American University of London in their CVs. Dr. Robert Oakes, a psychologist from Birmingham who gives expert testimony in court cases, was awarded a PhD just 5 months after first submitting work. However, he told the programme that he'd spent 18 months on his own background research prior to this, and he'd already a registered psychologist based on a previous degree. Dr. Oakes said he believed AUOL was properly accredited, but he's now taken the qualification off his CV. Dr. Rita Bowser, a senior nuclear industry executive who is in charge of selling a new generation of reactors in the UK, was awarded a doctorate in business after submitting what she described as significant amounts of coursework. Her employer, Westinghouse, said she's well qualified for her job based on 30 years of experience and 2 previous degrees, including a master's from respected Georgia Tech. AUOL is listed as bogus by the agency that values degrees for the Italian government, and it's been blacklisted in 5 United States states, including Texas, where it's illegal to use any of its qualifications to get a job. Of course, most listeners will be aware of the famously litigious Gillian McKeith, who starred herself as Doctor, based on what appears to be a pamphlet she wrote for a now-defunct degree mill in the United States. Her so-called doctorate opened doors for her that would otherwise have been closed, particularly since her writings betray such a profound ignorance of the most simple biological and anatomical facts. She became a laughingstock to the vast majority of her previous audience and to champions of critical thinking everywhere. But this is where the problem gets serious, in my view. We've all probably come across people whose life story could be filed with equal validity under autobiography or under fiction, depending which part you're reading. The CV is a treasure trove of misdirections, smoke and mirrors, and straightforward lies. Research in 2010 suggested that 20% of people had embellished their CV for work. In terms of academic performance, people pump their grades, they overstate their activities at school and university, they describe themselves as somewhat more stellar than they really were. At some levels, it doesn't matter so much. Take GCSEs, for example. At the time they're taken, they're really critical in determining what opportunities will be offered to the student in the next couple of years. But later in life, they're less important because they've been superseded by either more study, more life experience, or usually a meld of the two. They are, in many respects, a hurdle rather than a qualification. In 2010, a woman in Plymouth was jailed for 6 months for claiming 2A levels which she didn't have. The 2A levels were the entry standard for her job in the NHS, so she clearly used her false claim to create a personal advantage. Around the same time, a man in Stoke-on-Trent was jailed for falsely claiming a master's and a doctorate when being awarded a senior NHS management role. In 2012, Julia Rawlinson took a job as a biology teacher in Torquay. Her doctorate in science psychology helped her get the role, as it had also helped her get the role of biology A-level examiner with Edexcel over a four-year period previously. She actually had no degree, no doctorate, and in fact seems to have had no post-school education at all. I used to know a psychotherapist and clinical supervisor in Hampshire who brought a refreshing degree of insight and challenge to his work, who would conduct group supervision in a way that made you challenge your assumptions and apply rigorous therapeutic standards to your work. Almost everyone saw him as a superstar, so it took us all by surprise when he was arrested for gaining a pecuniary advantage. What he'd done was to fake a PhD. He didn't even go to McKeith's lengths and write a few pages of nonsense and hand over a fat cheque. He'd simply given himself a PhD from a prestigious UK university and created and printed off a fake certificate to support the deception. He actually had sufficient genuine qualifications to do his work, but he'd used his PhD to promote himself above other candidates and also to give himself an air of authority that meant he had opportunities that others didn't get. Rather like the psychologist mentioned by the BBC, he too was an expert witness in child abuse cases, and his arrest meant that there were a number of people in prison for child sexual abuse who could immediately claim a mistrial and seek their freedom. At the other end of the spectrum, I know someone who hasn't got any demonstrable qualifications, makes no pretense about this, yet worked in a highly sensitive, highly secure field of microwave communications, as a senior technician and lately as a senior manager both in the UK and abroad. His several attempts at formal learning have ended in failure because he couldn't acquire or hook into the skills needed for study, even though his workplace and experience and his references were first class. Likewise, I'm sure many listeners will have encountered people who tell them, "Education? I've got a degree from the University of Life." These people tend to scorn formal education and prefer to focus on the skills and knowledge they've acquired over any years of experience. And this hooks straight back to the BBC story where we started. Many of the courses that offer these certificates, diplomas and degrees do so by calling on the candidate's prior learning. They call it accreditation of previous experiential learning. Simply put, they look at a CV and decide that the experience a person has had in life is equivalent to a degree, which is then awarded, often in exchange for a large sum of money. This flies in the face of what most people expect from a university degree. To quote a friend, Mark Bailey, without his permission, but still he shouldn't have posted it on Facebook, "Without going away and Googling and coming up with a treatise, I think the important thing is that a university is an organisation offering accredited qualifications based on a period of study and or research of comparable levels, irrespective, one hopes, of the particular organisation, so that a degree of a given classification from University X is of equal value to that from University Y. Qualifications obtained in return for a sum of money with no extra work required are regarded as valueless." The Oxford College for Research and PhD Studies has handed out a fair few PhDs in its time, almost all of them to powerful people in the Middle East. whilst claiming on his website that it awards no degrees and that nothing it gives should be construed as an educational award or scholastic approbation. PhD, that is. So that'll be the Oxford College for Research and PhDs, based, as you might expect, in Cork, Ireland. So let's look at one more in focus and consider whether a fake degree in these subjects might be of concern. Here's a UK university that offers degrees in 44 subjects, amongst which are aerospace engineering, astronomy and astrophysics, automotive engineering, biology, computer science and IT, construction management, economics, education, electrical engineering. They offer bachelor's, master's, MBA and PhD, and they state very clearly on their front page, no classes, no studying, no examinations, no assignments, accredited degree, reputable university, real campus. So going down to the FAQs on their website, one of the questions is, are the words like online or life experience mentioned in the degree documents? And they reply, your degree is just like any other UK conventional graduated degree, and so it's not applicable to use terms like online or life experience. Moreover, we don't offer this typical online type of degree. Our degrees are real, original and accredited. We just provide them through the backdoor method. We are indeed offering real, original, accredited degrees from a highly reputed university, and we have to take care of many persons in charge involved in the process, so we have to maintain the price accordingly. Following your degree order, you will get the following documents. 1. Original Accredited Degree Certificate. 1 set of student transcripts with examination results. 1 offer letter from university. 1 testimonial letter from university. And all on quality paper embedded with different watermarks to prevent counterfeiting. So, degree mills, fake qualifications and forged documents from real universities abound. So what does it mean to be qualified? What does it mean to have some letters after your name? There are 2 interconnected elements that come into play in working life in this arena. Qualification and competence. Certainly we've all encountered qualified people who are incompetent. And of course there are a number of routes to high performance that are built solely on a competence-based development. I wouldn't begin to claim that qualification is the be-all and end-all. In fact, I would probably go further and say that part of the trouble the UK faces is that it's emphasised qualification over competence. Successive governments have prioritised tertiary education and have denigrated technical skills as being somehow less than optimal. When, however, the qualification is falsely claimed as if to demonstrate credibility and confidence, then it's a different matter. We know that the appeal to authority is a natural tendency in human nature, something that sceptics try to avoid but can still be susceptible to, especially when attempting to validate a role in the spotlight. It's invidious, and the media have fallen prey to this over the years. A number of talking heads have proven to be far less qualified and competent in their subject than they pretended, and have mostly disappeared from our screens, some of them to jail, but not from the printed press. The problem is that the public, and we are all the public, can be misled into believing things that are simply not true, simply because a person in authority told them. Dave Gorman demonstrated this recently in a very witty way on his Modern Life is Goodish series, where he demonstrated that the Powerball in Finnish dishwashing tablets is actually a Smartie. But I'm not going to tell you the whole of that story because it's his, not mine. In my work, I often see jobs for counsellors and psychotherapists that demand that the applicant should be accredited. In small print, it often adds, or equivalent. This annoys me no end, because the only way to test whether a person is accredited is for them to submit themselves to the accreditation process and pass it. If they contravene professional standards, their accreditation could be removed. You can't remove someone's or equivalent. I recently started a course of dental treatment. You can be sure I much prefer to know that the dentist is qualified and registered rather than or equivalent. The idea that someone might buy a degree in dentistry online fills me with absolute dread.
that's just about it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen back to 4 years' worth of podcast archives. Also on our website, you can follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook, if you're into those sorts of things. And also, do follow the links to Helen Chersky's blog, where you can see that she's on a boat in the middle of nowhere and technology allowed us to talk to her. I'm still a bit impressed by that. That's all at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Liz Luckendorf, Drew Ray, Steve Page, Kevin Friary, and Satellite Phone Technology. The sketch in the moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Tonight?
Whoa, sorry, son, you can't come in.
Well, why not? I've not got trainers on.
This is a mouse-only nightclub, and you are clearly a Syrian hamster.
Well, no. This long hair's all experimental. My humans have been working on a cure for baldness.
Why? I've never seen a hamster need a comb-over before.
I'm a mouse, and it's not a cure for us. They graft new follicles onto us to see if human hair will regrow.
You must think I haven't got a full cheese board. You're an hamster.
No. I'm a regular here. Me and my mates love coming up the mouse hole every Friday night. It's the best rodent disco in the area.
Right, okay. Well, tell me about this experiment then.
Well, scientists have found that by clumping human hair follicles in 3D spheroids, well, tiny hairs are starting to reform. Well, there's a way to go, and there are side effects.
Yeah, I can see that. Your mate over there's all engorged, and he's sprouted antlers.
That's not a mouse. That's a moose.
A moose?
Typing error on the lab order. He's not with us.
Well, if I let you and your friends in, are you going to be causing any trouble? Groups like yours aren't called a mischief of mice for nothing, are they?
Well, we will be good. We just want to let our hair down, and that's not easy for us.
Oh, go on then. In you go. But easy on the cheese. And if I catch you lot making holes in the skirting board, you're out.
Thanks, mate. We're in. Ring Emmy. I've got a way to get all the hamsters in that's going to be as clever as when the squirrels got in pretending they are wearing scarves.